Our first speaker is Sharon Friedman. She's director of the Science and Environment Writing Program at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. Her research focuses on how scientific, environmental, and health risk issues are communicated to the public. She's done research on such issues as Three Mile Island, Fukushima, and Chernobyl, LR radon, dioxin, electromagnetic fields, and other nifty stuff. She's studying media coverage of environmental and health risks from nanotechnology and from hydraulic fracturing. She's the co-author of Reporting on the Environment, a Handbook for Journalists, and co-editor of two books, Communicating Uncertainty and and Scientists and Journalism Reporting Science as News. Is there anything else I should say about you?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Good enough. Thank you. I know a good number of you who are here already. I want to make four points today, and I'll try and just illustrate them with some data slides since I'm a quant. And give you some information about some of the research that we've been doing at the same time. One of the things is that research on media coverage or on public opinion can help give journalists an idea, information about the next big thing that might get covered. Now, I hope you'll never have to cover an East Coast earthquake, but we actually are doing research on that now because of the earthquake that occurred in Mineral, Virginia in 2011, and I'm part of a multidisciplinary team that's looking at this. And so as one of the things that we did a public opinion survey of four surrounding counties and people in Philadelphia about their feelings about whether they're at any risk for earthquakes or not. And let's get the first slide up. And so what you see here, this is very preliminary. We're still just putting the data together. As you can see that for the right side, or the blue and the purple side, most people do not feel they're at risk. And then there are a few that do feel they're at risk. Now, one of the more interesting things that we found out is that people who have experienced earthquakes previously are more prone to think that they will experience an earthquake in the 95 corridor from Washington to New York. We have also found from this information so far in our analysis that minority women are much more concerned about earthquakes in this area, and particularly about house destruction and injury to themselves and their others. And we were looking for what we called the white male effect, that the white males wouldn't be too interested in this because they don't perceive risk the same way others do. But what we found was the non-minority female effect. And we think that will hold throughout the rest of our analysis. So while we're hoping that there won't be an earthquake on the East Coast, our geologists that we're working with tell us that it's much more likely than one would expect, and that it's something that journalists might want to think about. Can we go to the next slide? Now, this is from a really long study that we've been doing that's a 12-year analysis, a database analysis of media coverage of nanotechnology's health and environmental risks. And first of all, let me tell you, we looked in 33 newspapers in the United States and the United Kingdom and two wire services. And over from 2000 to 2011, we found on the major newspapers only 415 articles in that 12-year span on health and environmental risks of nanotechnology. And we then added in Google Alerts, and also NHI is the New Haven Independent, which is a totally online newspaper that, with a foundation grant, hired a specialist science writer to cover nanotechnology issues. So we were able to evaluate the information. And I'm just showing you one of the slides about the paucity of coverage of environmental issues and concerns that has appeared all over in the United States and in the UK. And it is the least of all of the risks that we looked at, the health risks, societal risks, and environmental risks. Environmental risks were the lowest that were covered in the media. And so here are just five that we broke out, we actually had 20-some different risks for environment that we were coding for. And you can see there just isn't much there. All right. So that's it's an underreported issue that in a few years may have some really serious ramifications as more and more nanoproducts come on the market. There are currently 1,600 nanotechnology products on the market. You probably use some of them and don't even know it. And the end of the life cycle could have significant effects on environment, and nobody is writing about it. Okay, so that's another one. Next one. This, looking backwards and doing some comparisons, also is really helpful to try and evaluate the quality of media coverage. And in this article that I wrote for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, I had been lucky to have studied in the past media coverage of Three Mile Island and media coverage of the Chernobyl accident. And so the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists folks asked me if I would do a really quick and dirty review of Fukushima coverage and compare it to TMI and Chernobyl media coverage. And I only had a month to do it before deadline, and this was while the accident was going on. And so I took the first 2 weeks of the Fukushima accident and tried to compare them to the first 2 weeks of the Three Mile Island and Chernobyl coverage. And so what we focused in on radiation reporting, which is a critically important area and is very technical and hard to understand and even harder to explain. And so what we did was take a look at what had happened, and I was really pleased to see that we had these results, that there were many more articles that included radiation information in the Fukushima coverage. The radiation numbers were far more complete by a government scale than had been recommended. The explanation of radiation health effects were more frequent and much more in-depth. Many more graphics, and boy, did they help try and explain a really complex subject. And internet was, you know, just invaluable. There were 22,400,000 Google hits in the first 2 weeks on Fukushima and radiation. So that just gives you an idea of how many people were concerned about it. And the last one. Oh, this is kind of. So this is something I've done. This is a website, I should say, my students have done, that we have up. It's now in its second year. We're going to start our third year, covering Marcellus Shale in the Pennsylvania region. This is our website, and you can see we've got the home course. I want to show you the research page in a minute. Video speakers and reports. It's almost all done by the students, with a lot of editing by somebody else named me. And the project is based on what they do is, this is a final term paper, but it's not a term paper, it's a website paper. It involves a little introduction, a major discussion of a topic in fracking that they're interested in, an interview, a discussion of four sites their readers should go to, an annotated bibliography. And when I asked the students when we were first doing this, who should be the audience for this website and their information, they said other Lehigh students, because they don't know anything about it. So that's what our audience is like. First year, it was just totally print. Second year, we added in videos by all of the students, so there's a video page on there too. If you go to the last slide, this will just show you the topics that got A's or A minuses in last fall's project. And you can see that some of these students aren't journalism students. One is in global studies. Another is in behavioral neurosciences. Some science writing students, integrated degrees, we call it ideas, in engineering, arts, and science. So she's a science writing minor. Cognitive science. And you can see the variety. This was out of 17 students. And so we had a fairly good grouping. The first time I taught it, out of 15 students, we only got 5 papers. And interestingly enough, they were mostly by the environmental studies students. This year, this past fall, they turned out to be a very different group of students, and you can see an interesting array of topics that they covered. So if anybody would like to see this, if you'd like to go onto the website, the address is marcellus-shale.lehigh.edu. There's no at there because it's a shorthand. But if you can't find it, just put in Marcellus Shale Lehigh University in Google and it'll come up. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Our second speaker is Michael Cordes. He's an author and photojournalist, associate director of the Center for Environmental Journalism, University of Colorado in Boulder. He has 25 years of experience as a photojournalist, a reporter, a writer, and author of the best-selling book, High Crimes, The Fate of Everest in an Age of Greed. He's working on his next book, which he says should be for sale at the SEJ conference next year in Oklahoma, called Megafire, and it's about the global increase in wildfires.
Yeah, thanks for not mixing that up. Being from Boulder, when I mentioned I'd written a book called High Crimes, he assumed I was writing about legal pot. So, anyway. Yeah, I don't know. Bruce Barcott's got a book coming out, and I don't know what he's calling it. But anyway, so I had an entirely different presentation put together, and I just changed it this morning because I just got this link. So I've been I cover a lot of different things, but I've been working on the fire crisis for a long time, and we've been doing a lot of fire reporting out of the Center for Environmental Journalism, and particularly since the tragedy in Arizona, a little over a year ago, I've had a lot of requests both to do stories and do journalism in a variety of different forms, but also to be a source. And so I did an interview with KQED Radio maybe a year ago at a time when I was doing all kinds of different media appearances, and you know, it kind of went away, and I don't recall ever hearing anything, but also kind of forget some of these. And I got a link this morning saying, hey, that interview, you know, was really great. We turned it into a comic, and they sent me this link. And so this is what KQED just published out of this, which is largely from this interview that I did and a scientist. So here is Bob Minich, who's a fire scientist whose work I'm very familiar with. And we teach in the Center for Environmental Journalism, we are increasingly teaching what we call transmedia. So transmedia, in our definition, is multimedia across multiple channels. So in our reporting on the environment class, where we cover wildfire, we have traditional print stories, we have videos. Last year we did videos on elephant poaching for The Guardian and On Earth out of the Center for Environmental Journalism with our students, and I collaborated with the Denver Post on a half-hour documentary about the wildfire crisis that just won an Emmy. And I'm not saying that to boast about winning an award. I'm just trying to get people to wrap their heads around the fact that a newspaper just won an Emmy award. We are working in an entirely different media landscape where there's all kinds of things that we can do, right down to the one student who interviewed people who were not comfortable being shown in photos and video. So she took the oral history of her interviews, turned it into a stage play tied to our project where actors go up and read what these people said about what had happened to them in these fires. So this is what we call transmedia. It's very impressive. It's a really effective method of storytelling. It's also really intimidating to subjects and to scientists who are very focused on getting the facts right and the details right. It's one thing when you have maybe a newspaper story or a broadcast, but when you have all of these different forms that might be dealing with the science that they're working on, and they may be comfortable with you quoting them in a certain style in a newspaper story, but not comfortable with that same quote if it's radio or broadcast. I have no idea how Bob Minich feels about suddenly having himself be a cartoon character, based on my work here, with this fire burning behind him. Maybe he's okay with that, but I know a lot of fire scientists that I've dealt with, and I've interviewed hundreds at this point, who probably would not like this and might be really upset about it. There's other things in it, too. So that's me. And so journalists have to get comfortable with this too. This new landscape is really challenging for both sides. We have really this amazing toolbox, and what I like to teach is that the toolbox is incredibly democratic. There's just fabulous things that we can do. You don't need to know how to do each one of these things, but you do need to know how to look at the toolbox and recognize that, hey, this would be a great story for a motion graphic, or this would be a perfect story to be done in audio. Much like being, a handyman working on a house, you may be able to pound a nail and you may be able to do a few fix-its here and there, but you need to recognize that, wow, that's an electrical problem. I should probably get an electrician in. And the same thing with this. You know, there's a lot of collaborative work that we do, and working with scientists is often very collaborative, but it's also really intimidating. So I'm going to switch over from this to the presentation I was starting with, and I'm really sorry because I have this great 7-minute clip, and I was only going to show a portion of it, of one fire whirl in the Australian outback, and I have, I think it's 48 different broadcast outlets around the world. Yeah, so it's, you know, in Korean, Fire World or Fire NATO. They all call it Fire NATO. And, in all of these different places, talking about Fire NATOs and just, you know, what it was that made this go viral, why journalists really loved seeing this fire tornado, and why so many fire scientists who saw this just pounded their head going, oh my God, this is just so, it's such a terrible illustration of our science and the work we've done. So, the term viral is something that goes around a lot now. We look for viral media, and in that I kind of see this basic disconnect that we have to work to get over. And I think that these problems aren't that hard to solve. But, you know, scientists see virulence as a hazard. Journalists, we want to go viral. And part of that is, it's not necessarily the most becoming word for basically newsworthiness. You know, virality is just newsworthiness, but viral can go, to very bad places for scientists. So if anybody's followed the recent scandal on Shark Week where, a scientist's work was taken completely out of context intentionally to make a documentary more dramatic, and Megalodon, this monster shark fake documentary that they made where they flash for maybe 20 seconds, this is a fantasized documentary, but then the whole show goes on and, you would have no idea, and scientists were really upset by that. And Shark Week in general has gone from being kind of seen as a great way to get people interested in oceans to being a very corrupting thing of science. Right down to now, you have a lot of people out there that really can't tell the difference between Megalodon and Sharknado, which I love this poster just because, enough said, we get it. So we even disdain the term viral. But we really do strive for it, and at its core, virulence in media is just newsworthiness. So I thought what I would do here is talk a little bit about what we teach as the basic just foundations of what makes something newsworthy, and why what we see as being newsworthy is something that scientists would be uncomfortable with, and how we can overcome those things. So here are the modern news values that I will teach next week to the incoming students at the University of Colorado. And this is a photo I took in the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant in Connecticut. And I'll get back to that in a minute. So if you talk about Fire NATO, monster sharks, Mythbusters, if you look at how science is portrayed in much of popular media now, the newsworthy aspect that we really latch onto is novelty. So much science reporting is humor, right down to that comic. A lot of scientists aren't really thrilled about the fact that their research is presented as humorous. Some are really good at it, and some are really good storytellers using humor, but not every scientist is. And so it only takes once for a scientist to feel as though you've made fun of them, or maybe they're doing research that is easy to make fun of, or easy to make a really clever headline to put them off. And I have a friend who's a geneticist who has done really fabulous work, and she's very good at working with the media now, but she learned to work with the media because she had a very bad experience where she did a genetic test on Colorado state fish and discovered that the fish that they were stocking throughout Colorado was actually a different subspecies of the fish. And actually, there's only one place in Colorado where you can find the greenback cutthroat trout, and it's not in its native habitat. It's in a place where it was stocked 100 years ago. And of course, it's kind of a funny story, so journalists latched onto that, and the national story that went out was with the headline, "Oops, Wrong Fish." Well, that made her job really hard because it made it sound like she's making fun of the state who she has to be able to collaborate with. So the next time a journalist gets in touch with her, she's really gun-shy because it's like, you know, they really yelled at me. Suddenly I'm, you know, not getting the kind of collaboration and cooperation that I, you know, was getting before because, you know, my work was seen to have been, you know, both funny and critical in a way that I hadn't intended it. So, you know, I don't know if you guys go to This Week in Science, which is kind of a cool little website, but almost all of their takes are humorous. There's times when that works, and there's times when that's going to be off-putting to certain scientists, and that's something that you need to overcome by letting them know, hey, this is really a funny story, or, you know, maybe you can just tip your hand a little bit that, you know, you're seeing this in a humorous light. You know, nobody wants to put 2 or 3 or 4 years of their life into research and then feel as though it just came down to a really quick, clever, funny headline, and then they're forgotten. So novelty means funny. Scientists aren't necessarily comfortable putting their work into a humorous light. This is a marine biologist named Peter Oster, and I went to make a photograph of him for a project I was working on, and I have a source at the Environmental Defense Fund saying, hey, you know, I know you're supposed to, you know, Peter will want to show you the submarine that they work out of. It's really cool and it's really dramatic, but you really have to go look at his office. And so I went to see his office and immediately thought, this is the picture. Yeah, this is so much more storytelling than yet another scientist sitting with his cool machine. And Peter was really good with it, but there were several of his colleagues that kind of interrupted and almost pushed us towards the submarine, go, you don't want, you know, to be seen in this light. And so the fact that I could explain to him that, yeah, you know, it is going to be a funny picture, but it's actually a really storytelling picture. You know, it shows, you know, you've been at this for a long time. You're submerged in all this research. You can't even sit in your desk chair because you got all these papers stacked up on it. And just by explaining to him why funny was going to work and why I wasn't going to just use this to make fun of you, but it was going to be storytelling, we were going to put it in context, was enough to make him comfortable to say, okay, yeah, sure, I'll sit back down and just keep working. You know, I've got this I've got to do. And that worked out to make a pretty good picture. So prominence, another element of newsworthiness. So here we've got, you know, probably the most covered scientist around right now. We've also got Arnold Schwarzenegger as a firefighter and Harrison Ford in Indonesia with an orangutan. Scientists aren't necessarily thrilled with that a lot of the time because you pick the celebrity to tell their story rather than them. Sometimes the celebrity gets it right, sometimes the celebrity doesn't, and they feel as though they've done all the work and now we're going to get somebody who's prettier or better known to come in and tell you about my work as though it's my credit. Celebrities aren't always human. This is Staccato, the whale. This is, you know, one of the last less than 300 northern right whales. And this is Staccato 2 weeks after I took that picture. Staccato was killed in a boat strike. That was the last picture that of that whale alive. And so, you know, thinking in terms of who is the celebrity that's going to tell this story, you know, in this case, you know, what was prominent was this whale. A lot of researchers weren't thrilled with me doing this story in a place that's basically a marine mammal graveyard. So again, trying to present them as the, you know, the species, the animals were what this was going to be about, rather than the researchers, was something I needed to explain. That, you know, people are going to latch onto this because of these animals, and we'll get to your research and we'll present it, but first thing we have to do is make people pay attention. This is on Mount Everest during my last project, and so I did some work on glaciation there. I can tell you for sure the Tribune newspapers would never have done this story if it wasn't being done on Mount Everest. So if you're having trouble getting your research covered, try doing it on Mount Everest. That's, you know, a great way, you know, so, you know, another form of prominence. It's a celebrity mountain. I've got some off-color lines about it that I'll share over drinks later. So scientists often see celebrities, be they actors, animals, events, or mountains, as imprecise methods of conveying scientific data. So you need to convince them that you know what you're talking about, that you're going to get to their scientific data. And one way to get around that that's worked for me is indicating to them that you've read the research. You know, very often, if I can just go in and give them the details out of it, no, I've read your paper and I get it. Can you clear this up for me and this up for me, that you've actually read the paper? Puts a lot of scientists at ease. It's like, wow, you went that far as to actually read this dense paper. And you're, you know, it convinces them that you're not just latching onto this for the quick hit, but that you actually are going to get to it. Timeliness. So this is the 100th Osprey that returned to Connecticut after DDT was banned. And so I was doing a project where I circumnavigated Long Island Sound in a sea kayak for a series of environmental stories. And timeliness is something that you measure in a lot of different ways. But what's interesting about this is that scientists, researchers, and journalists don't necessarily use or see the benefit of numbers in the same way. So the scientists I dealt on this gave me these incredibly dense numbers on, you know, the amount of poisons that were being found in eggs, and you know, it's really dense material that's very hard to convey. My readers, on the other hand, can totally remember 100th ospreys back to Connecticut. But they can't remember any of those other numbers and details. And so you kind of have to explain to the researcher again, I'm going to get to all this. I won't be able to get into all these dense numbers. People aren't going to understand that. And we're doing this 100th Osprey because this is the best storytelling method. This is my first wildfire photo. And so so when you're dealing with breaking news tied to science, well, scientists work on things for years. And I remember, you know, seeing a story where a scientist criticized the reporting on the story. Well, their response to it was, look at this report. The report took 5 years. The journalist turned around the story for the next day's paper. You know, the scientist is seeing, you know, the urgency of the research in a very different light than the journalist is, who has to turn this around while people are paying attention. Proximity. This is also from Long Island Sound. I'm doing something on hypoxia in this story. And here, it's just showing them how are we, you know, creating this dead zone. Well, what I really wanted to do was a story about the dead zone in the Gulf, you know, off of New Orleans here. But I did it in Connecticut with, you know, people laying this sod for a lawn on a rocky island that basically would not support life without it, because my readers will pay attention to what affects the waterway that they see every day. And I can use that as an entree into the bigger issue. Again, you know, I'm talking to researchers that really want me to focus on the Gulf. And I have to explain to them, well, to get people to pay attention to the Gulf, I got to get them to pay attention to their own backyard first. So proximity can be people as well as places. Number of people researchers I was dealing with were upset about this choosing this particular researcher. This was the researcher from Connecticut. This is where the paper was based. So going out with her, crawling around in the rainforest when I was doing stories on deforestation, was a way for me to make sure that I got this story into a prominent place. But I had to explain to the researcher who, you know, she's a postdoc working for a big researcher who doesn't happen to be from the same location. So I'm having to explain to him, look, I don't mean to disrespect you, but she's from, you know, where my readers are from, and this is going to help me get this story read. And he was actually really cool with it once I explained it. This is Frank Hubbard, who is a geneticist at Yale, and this is in the Peabody Museum, a mural there. Again, in this case, it's how do you illustrate, you know, this guy's genetic work, finding a really famous mural that a lot of the readers of our paper know, and placing him with that was a way to kind of put his research in, you know, make it feel more relevant to our readers who were local.
Michael, I'm going to have to cut you off.
Okay.
I'm sure people will want to ask you, what did we see? So when we get to...
Well, let's see. We've got impact and conflict.
There you go.
Juliet Pinto is associate professor in the Department of Journalism and Broadcasting at Florida International University. She studies environmental communication in Spanish language and English language media. She earned her doctorate in communication from the University of Miami, her master's in marine affairs and policy from the University of Miami, and her bachelor's in environmental science from Boston University.
Hi, thanks so much for coming, and it's a real pleasure to be on this panel, so I really appreciate this opportunity. I'd like to follow up on the previous two presentations with sharing with you all some of our experience in Miami about communicating sea level rise in South Florida across teaching, research, and service collaborations in our attempts to raise awareness and engage a really diverse community around this issue. Okay. This one. So I'm talking about South Florida, but what I'm really going to be focusing on is our work in Miami-Dade. And FIU, if you're not familiar with it, it's located in South Miami. The journalism school is in a satellite campus in North Miami. So can you? And if you've ever been to Miami, you know it's a very interesting place. So it's pretty densely populated. It's pretty big. We have a lot of people coming in and out each year, and it's very low. So the average elevation is only 6 feet above mean high water. In most places, when you think about going inland, you think about going up. And to a certain extent, that happens in Miami because we have something called the coastal ridge, which runs along through it. And when I say ridge, I mean you might hit 10 feet or 12 feet. But then you go back down to sea level and slip into the Everglades. Over half of the population were born in other countries. 66% identify themselves as Latinos, including my kids. 72% speak a language other than English at home, and we have about 1 in 5 below the poverty level. Thank you. Go ahead. Oh, that's it, yeah. So there's plenty of stuff for us to talk about when we were thinking about, you know, what we as journalism educators can take up as subjects for classes or build programs around. We have a lot to deal with there. You know, everything from dredging of Biscayne Bay, which kills off the seagrasses, to depletion of our freshwater aquifer, the Biscayne Aquifer, to invasive species, the lack of solar energy in the Sunshine State, Turkey Point nuclear reactors that, if the sea rises as projected, will be sitting out in the middle of the ocean. You know, lots of stuff that we can cover and do cover. But what we as a journalism school chose to take on was sea level rise. And I'm probably telling you what you already know, but obviously for us in Miami, this is a very pressing and urgent issue. Because of our low elevation, there's really nowhere for the water to run off to. We have this canal system, which is a way of actively moving water off the landscape, much as they have here in New Orleans. We have issues with saltwater intrusion. And the water seeps in from below because we're sitting on porous limestone rocks. So you can't build a levee or a dike to keep the water out. It will literally bubble up from under your feet. And all of this means big changes are on the horizon for us. Long before the water comes up, we're going to be dealing with things like getting a 30-year mortgage, getting flood insurance, being able to sell our homes. So it's a very pressing issue for us. And this graph represents the projections that the Army Corps came up with a few years ago, that 4 counties in South Florida, Broward, Palm Beach, Monroe, and Miami-Dade, have adopted as a unified set of projections, which tells us that in a short span of time, we're already looking at a half foot of sea level rise, which will mean major, major impacts for South Florida residents and infrastructure. So there's lots going on. Miami Beach, one of the most visible faces of sea level rise, is taking a really aggressive and progressive stance. And I say that compared to what was happening only 5 years ago. So this year alone, they've budgeted $400 million for pumps and other infrastructure. They're putting in 3 new ones. They're finishing them up right now. They should be in before the king tide that's coming the first week of October, which is going to be the highest one in 50 years, and usually results in significant flooding in Miami Beach and in other areas. Beach renourishment, living walls, new building standards, seawall heights. Seawalls now must be, I believe, 5-plus feet above, and it's NAVD or NA. I always get those acronyms confused, the elevation terms that they have. Regionally, we have the South Florida Climate Change Task Force, which is what I mentioned earlier, the 4 counties working together, political leaders, experts, academics, citizens, NGOs, to develop a series of ideas for policy and for infrastructure, and they're working on implementing a few of those now. However, there still is a need for increased public awareness of sea level rise and its impacts. And I say that knowing that Curtis Morgan's fabulous work over the past few decades, he's been covering this issue heavily. David Fleshler has been covering this heavily, but for whatever reason, a lot of people are unaware that the water that they're speeding through in Miami is not rainwater. It didn't just rain. It's salt water that came up through the drainage system, through the pipes, and is spilling out onto the street. And that may be because of the nature of the population of Miami, because it's such a transient population, because it's such a culturally diverse population. We're just not sure, but we've done some research, which I'll talk about in a little bit, that gives us more of an idea about that. We have, I don't know if you know, but we have Rick Scott as a governor and Marco Rubio as a senator, so obviously there's little state and little political will to take this on. Our school does not have a cohesive or a program in place for environmental communication, as some of you all do. So what we've done is sort of piecemeal at this point, although we're moving toward a program in science or environmental communication. I've developed pretty much the only courses in the university, two for our school and then two for the Department of Earth and Environment on environmental communication. And we're trying to communicate this information across platforms to very fragmented niche audiences who often speak all types of languages, Portuguese, Spanish, Hebrew, Russian, you name it. So it's a real challenge. So one thing we did is a documentary that aired on our local PBS affiliate in January, and it actually originated from a sea level rise tour that I led in Miami in 2011 for SEJ with your colleague Tom Uelsman from CU Boulder. And one of my colleagues, Kate McMillan, came on the tour, brought a camera. She's a television producer who's worked in public television for 30-some years. And at the end of the tour said, oh my goodness, this is a story. What a story. Let's tell this story. So I said, great. And so 2 years later, with absolutely no outside funding other than a $1,200 summer research grant that we got from FIU, we made this documentary, 26 minutes. It aired on WPBT2. It was picked up by PBS NewsHour in March for an 8-minute segment, and then Dave Fleshler used it in the Sun Sentinel for a cover piece on sea level rise in April. And it's been viewed a lot for, you know, for the platforms that we've been able to put it on. And I have the trailer if... Oh.
Southeast Florida, we are one of the most sea level rise vulnerable places on the earth.
It could be a sunny day, and we could have 2 weeks of a lot of water. And I'm not talking about a puddle here and there.
Some people go, oh, we broke a sewer main, or a water main broke. That's not what it is. That's sea level rise.
No one wants to pay increased taxes or fees. But if people want to live here, we have to make these investments to do the infrastructure planning, the pump systems, all the stuff that needs to be done so that we can stay habitable.
I see no way that we could have less than 4.5 feet sea level rise by the end of the century. That is the absolute low end.
Okay, and that shot of the cars going through the salt water was last year's King Tide, and we stood there while we were shooting and literally watched like Ferraris and Lamborghinis just go shooting through it, and knowing that they were just rusting those $100,000 undercarriages. So we worked on this with just, you know, each other and some cameras and interested students. So I had my graduate assistant who was very, very Spanish language. She's in her Spanish language master's program. She was as obsessed with this topic as we were, and her husband just happened to be a videographer. So they came out and helped us. And she actually turned this into her Spanish language professional project. So she just defended it and graduated. And I can give you that link if anyone's interested in that. Okay. Can you click through? Another area that we're working in terms of service, Miami Beach government and the Public Works Department has come to FIU and said, please help us, make recommendations, give us your expertise. So we've been working with them in a variety, you know, interdisciplinary working groups, which you can see here. I'm involved in the communication group that also does GIS and mapping. Go ahead. And then we have some grant-funded activities. So we won a Challenge Fund grant from the Online News Association and the Knight Foundation and McCormick and some others. It's a consortium where they challenged us to hack our curriculum. And we decided to do that using Sea Level Rise. So we instituted some new courses. We're teaching right now a web GIS course that where the students are creating an app to show flooding. So people can go out with their smartphone, take a picture, send it in to us, and we'll create a map and give people interactive experiences with how water is moved on and off of the landscape. We're doing a King Tide Day event where we are bringing high school students, K through 12 educators, our own students, as well as geology and geophysics and engineering and a couple other graduate students. We're taking a boat around Miami Beach with a balloon and a camera, and we're going to film the coast before, during, and after the King Tide, as well as we have sensors that the students are going to be doing, again, crowd hydrology, where they're going to be measuring water quality before, during, and after the floodwaters recede. Along with this, we're going to have our students who are going to be shooting video that are going to be put on the local public television station. And we've got a website, and we've got a proposal in for a second documentary to focus on Miami Beach business resiliency, where we focus on the financial and legal aspects to sea level rise. So lessons learned, when you're looking for grants, you have to leave your silo. You have to form an interdisciplinary team where everyone is on, you know, everyone has their role, everyone stays in their field, but we're working together to tackle these multifaceted, multi-dimension, very complex issues. Important to have really good working relationships with partners in various sectors. So for our project for the ONA Challenge Fund, we're calling it Eyes on the Rise. So it's eyesontherise.org. And we're partnering with the local public television, the South Florida Water Management District, a climate literacy education group called CLEO. Am I leaving anyone out? A GIS department, some faculty members, and probably other people that I'm leaving out. Oh, Mast Academy, which is a local high school that's focused on marine science. So we've got people, you know, in public, private sectors. You need a good understanding of culture and communicating environmental issues. So for us, I've done some research with Eric's colleagues, Bruno Takahashi and Manuel Chavez, where we have interviewed Spanish language media professionals, editors, reporters, and we asked them, why aren't you covering climate change? I also did another paper where we looked at climate change in Spanish language, major national press, in Hispanic press. Zero, nothing. It's non-existent. It's not there. And we said, why aren't you covering it? And they gave us two very different answers. The first one was, our audiences don't care about it. They don't have that education. They don't come from countries where there's recycling. They get here, they don't care about it. They care about immigration and the economy. That's it. And on the other hand, the other half told us, they really did care about it back in Latin America, where everyone lives much more healthily, closer to the land, better relationship with food, et cetera, but then they get here and they see that the gringos don't care about it, so they get acculturated to us, that we don't care about it. So we have to figure that out. But obviously culture is a very important variable in how audiences understand environmental information or are interested in it, frankly. Bringing students in across academic units is also important, so that means support from academic units university-wide. And what I'm seeing at FIU is, while there is very strong interest in our school, there's almost stronger interest from other units who really want to become more media savvy, develop those multimedia skills, and really understand how to better communicate. We have to share environment or share resources by telling human stories across multiple platforms, as you talked about. And get past, don't even start with the question of this debate over climate change. I get so angry every single time I read a news article where that's how they started out, the debate over climate change, and then they move on. With the documentary, we 2 years ago, we said we're starting with this is what's happening. This is what's happening. This is how we know it's happening. This is what's being done. This is what we still need to do. But all of this, you know, all of this that we're doing still doesn't answer the big, big question in Miami and in South Florida, which is how much are people going to pay to live in Miami-Dade? Because that's what it's going to come down to. And if we can't get our community engaged around this issue now, then I can tell you the answer is not going to be very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
No worries.
Questions and comments, please identify yourself and your affiliation.
I can present. Have hundreds and hundreds of news stories, news items that global scientists are interested in many, many fields. There is no shortage of news, especially in the last year or two, about climate and the environment changing. But I have a shortage of ideas about how to get people interested in it. And you have done that.
And who's going to start?
Thank you so much. And, you know, what we decided that our approach was going to be community engagement. So we decided that we were going to, you know, it's a hyper-local little documentary that has resonance with other coastal communities around the world. And so we employed social media. We worked with a lot of different partners. You know, we kind of took a multifaceted approach to how we were going to get the message out and get people interested. But, you know, with sea level rise in Miami, you don't have to work very hard because it's just becoming impossible to ignore anymore. And to the extent that the Miami-Dade Commission now has a sea level rise task force, and the chair of that is a Republican Cuban American, and very interested in the theme, really reaching out. Things have changed and moved so fast now, so it wasn't hard to get people interested in that particular topic.
So, you know, I'm sea level rise versus wildfire, so sea level rise is probably going to be the most costly thing from climate change, at least, you know, if you look at impacts on communities and infrastructure and so forth. Wildfire, on the other hand, is very, very dramatic. And so that's been, you know, pretty easy for me to get, you know, book contracts and do short docs and do stuff with our students. One of the challenges there, as far as working with science, is that it is, you know, wildfire, it's climate, there's a climate signal in it, and climate is part of it, but it's really only part of it. And, you know, there are really big issues with development and the fact that we build our houses and put our infrastructure in really stupid places, and there are aspects of forest management that play into it. And so it's really important that while you present climate, you need to put it in the context of all of these other scientific forcings. And that's really important, at least for my work, because, you know, if I go, you know, they've dealt with this a lot, the scientists and the fire community that I deal with, and it alienates them because, you know, they know that the story is more complex than that, and that if you just oversimplify it to just being climate, you know, there's a significant scientific community that sees that as a significant betrayal of the science. That, you know, that is one prong of a very complex issue, and that's one of the things that I think is really challenging for us to communicate in this, is that science is nuanced and science is, you know, full of complexities, and you aren't going to be able to explain all of those, but you do need to leave your viewers and readers understanding that they exist and that this is part of a very, you know, dynamic and complicated story.
Well, I think I just wanted to respond to your comment, and that is what we're seeing here is that you have to break the climate change issues down, that climate change as an entity is just too big for people to absorb and relate to. And so if you can break it down into various aspects, particularly if it's going to affect the reader, the viewer, the person looking on at YouTube or so on, in some way, then you can get them to pay attention to it. But when you talk about climate change as an entity, people just glaze over. And so you have to make it a smaller problem so that they can have the possibility of being able to cope with it and maybe even deal with it.
A comment here or a question?
No. I'm Annie Blair. I teach environmental journalism at Miami University of Ohio. And, you know, we're doing a lot of the same things you guys are with our students using our own research. We have a pretty strong science faculty and curriculum. And so us journalists, we're partnering and communicating their research as best we can in local media and other places. But my question to you is, right now we're scrambling to find grant money to expand that. And we're not a big school. We're not a school of journalism. We don't have those funding sources. You got an ONA grant. I'm interested in that. But where do you see funding sources out there, potential that, you know, to connect research with communication? And I have to tell you, a lot of my students are not journalism majors. They are masters of environmental science and PhD students. And so where can we find the funding, especially for smaller schools?
Relatively small school. And one of the things we do is try and partner with our scientists in putting in grants. So we do interdisciplinary research. So right now I'm working with geologists and civil engineers, and I'm doing the communications aspects of it on that earthquake grant. And we're writing a big proposal to go into NSF next month in order. And by the way, if you want to apply to NSF, you're not going to get money for media stuff, so you have to sneak it under the scientist aspect in order to be able to get into it. And we're doing the same thing with other social scientists in relation to our fracking research. So it's one of the ways to do it. It's really tough to get grants just for communications and journalism studies. So partner with other groups that know how to get those grants and just sneak your research into it.
I totally agree, Sharon. It's so important to get into those working groups. So now that I'm in this working group with Miami Beach, I get emails every day from faculty in geophysics and marine science and engineering saying, hey, look, here's this grant opportunity. Do you want to work on this? We need a communication aspect. And I would have never known about that otherwise, because I am so focused on looking for money for specific stuff that we do. So if you can get in some university-wide or college-wide groups like that and meet like-minded people, I think it's invaluable to do that.
I just want to add that many of the federal grants to scientists require a social science cooperation aspect of it. If you can make yourself the social science aspect of it, then that's really helpful. People do come all the time and say, won't you sign on to our grant? And I keep saying, well, I don't even know what you're doing. And of course they come in a day before they're going to submit the grant, because the Office of Research says, well, where's your social science component? And immediately communication comes up as the social science component. Well, if they give you enough time and if you're interested in the topic, then you have a great opportunity to work with these folks and get research money that way.
Dave?
Yeah, just a comment and a quick question. Oh, hi, I'm sorry. I'm Dave Polson with Michigan State University. So I agree with that, and we've done some of that stuff as well in terms of partnering with folks and grant opportunities that you wouldn't have been aware of otherwise, and communication strategies that the scientists would totally have botched and done poorly, but still got funded for. And we might as well get funded and do it right. The caveat there, though, is I think we could be very, very careful that the piece that we're providing is journalism and not public relations. And when we look at that, those type of opportunities, you got to be clear, you know, and tell them, you know, this is the limit of where we can go with that. The question I have, though, is... So silos are easy to bust when they're your own silos. Well, I guess they're never easy to bust, but they're easier when they're your own. But when you're looking at collaborating between journalism faculty and non-journalism faculty, the other silos that you have to bust are the faculty to get them to cooperate, if not collaborate, with you. And Michael had pointed out some, you know, excellent examples of why faculty or science faculty are afraid of journalists. Well, if they're afraid of journalists, they ought to be afraid of student journalists. So I guess what I'm wondering is if you have any ideas and suggestions for maybe, you know, reaching out to those folks and building a level of trust with them that you're not going to botch their project and you really want to cover it well.
I'll start, and kind of a follow-up to the last question. There, you know, a lot of scientists are starting to reach out to us because there are, you know, the other aspect of some of these grants is that they're being required to do outreach, and they don't have the skill set for that. And so I've, you know, had a number of researchers who are getting science grants to come and talk about, you know, what is outreach? How can we work with you on that? So there are opportunities with that. And one thing, you know, in my list of the newsworthy elements, that is another thing that's very off-putting that I think you have to explain up front. And when I teach science writing, I teach it is that, you know, we used to joke about the cult of the white coat when I was in the newsroom, that, you know, a scientist and a researcher has to be covered like anybody else, you know, a politician or a businessman. You know, there's, you know, they get things wrong. And, you know, we've got, I don't know if you saw the story about the peer review ring that was broken up a few months ago with, you know, thousands of papers that were fraudulently peer reviewed and appeared in journals. And in my fire research, I've dealt with stuff where it wasn't malfeasance, but where, you know, the research they did has been strongly refuted. And, you know, that's something that scientists need to be prepared for, and also, you know, is something that's a little off-putting to them. And so, you know, that even makes it harder to get them out of their silos.
Yeah, I'll just say, you know, also what, in our case, we chose a topic that is kind of a university imperative. So there's already a lot of different people from across the university working on it who actively want to work together. So we didn't just choose something, you know, out there. We chose something that is of really significant importance for the region, and our university has starting a sea level rise institute, as a matter of fact. So, you know, it's something that really helped. I also agree, though, that you have to be very clear from the beginning, and I've had to give this lecture a number of times, that we're not PR. We control our own content, and we are presenting information. We're not doing it strategically for your agenda or for anyone else's, which often, you know, not often, but sometimes can be a revelation, but you have to make that clear from the get-go.
I think there was a question or comment here.
I have a question right behind you.
I'm Sarah Peach from UNC Chapel Hill. So I think you've already started to answer my question, but I was going to ask you and Michael and Sharon as well, how do you sort of handle those conversations? Because I have been approached as well by a scientist who is saying things like, well, you know, I'm going to be the PI with this NSF grant, so why shouldn't I be able to review? I don't want to have your reporting have inaccurate science when I'm the PI, which is, I totally understand where he's coming from.
I think one of the things that you need to establish right away is you may be the PI, but I'm going to be the co-PI on some of this and try and say that my research, not, and you don't be as blunt as this, but my research is just as important as yours. And come in as a partner and not as an aide in some way. And it takes a bit of going back and forth to try to make them understand that social science is a science, and that if you're doing that kind of work that's going to augment some of the things that they need to do, that your work is just as respectable and gets in journals as theirs does. And so it's really, you come in, they come to you with this business of, well, you can write this up and you can do the PR and all of that, and or you'll organize the workshops that we need to do for outreach. And you just have to stop and say, no, that's not what we do here. And we do research and we do it accurately, and we are as much a scientist as you are in many ways, just a different way of doing it, and establish a partnership. And it takes a while to do that. But if they don't want to do that, then you don't want to participate.
And we have time for one more comment or question, and then we officially end, but you can keep talking until it's either the secretary be here or you don't. He'll be on YouTube.
Hi, my name is Tyson Miller. I'm from the Project for Improved Environmental Coverage. We're a nonprofit trying to support some strengthening in this area. And we were coordinating a working group on Wednesday with a range of players, and coalition building was one of the pieces identified. And specifically, one of the questions that our group was kind of wondering about is, to what extent are other journalism and mass communication schools kind of around the country integrating sort of the environment and environmental reporting as a core aspect of what's being taught or how the students are engaged? For folks in the room or on the panel, are you seeing it much? And if not, do you think that there would be utility or an opportunity there for you all who are doing it to help others in this area?
Well, I never think that there's enough. I think that there's a little bit, grassroots stuff here and there that we deal with, and in reality, we're that too. I would love to see more of a collaboration or a network of programs that do what we all do, so that we can share best practices, so that maybe we can share some of the techniques or technologies that have been successful for all of us. The media landscape has changed a lot from when I was in New York and throwing elbows with a bunch of other people, and that's what you were competing. That's what competition was, and now we're all kind of competing with American Idol. And I think maybe we can teach journalism in a way where it's much more collaborative. We're not always thinking that, boy, if they get this story and I don't have it, I've been beaten. Whereas hey, maybe I can help them get this story, and all boats will rise.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I would love to have some sort of network like that where we could learn from each other. And we were just at a business meeting where we were asking how to get more students involved in SEJ, and I think having some kind of system where they can talk to each other and learn from each other, as well as us who teach the classes, would just be fantastic.
All right, well, let me thank the panelists.